Always Getting Ready is a close, personal examination of seasons and subsistence. In photographs and in words, this new book chronicles a year's cycle in the life of the Yupik people of Southwest Alaska. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. On this edition, the creator of Always Getting Ready, photographer and author Jim Barker, and its editor, Robin Barker. Welcome to the both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This book is very much about people as they move through a year's seasons. Mm-hmm. But it is as much about the land on which they live. Early in the book, you describe the land in one fairly telling phrase where you say that the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is a tenuous compromise that the land has made with the sea. Tell me what that means to you.
There's when you climb off the airplane out there, and that's about the only way that you can arrive there. I noticed that and I was struck, and most people who arrive for the first time, is they have this extraordinary 180-degree view in all directions. Mountains are right on the horizon line. They're just kind of like a dream over there, and that's all. And there's this openness that is startling. It's kind of, at first, the land has this kind of a golf course flatness to it that you can see just infinite directions if the weather is good. And it visually, it's a very, very striking place because you can just see so much. The sky becomes a very prominent thing in your vision, and you watch weather and watch clouds a lot because there's nothing to interrupt it.
Mm-hmm. This tenuous compromise between land and sea, does that have to do with the fact of the two rivers being so close together at some point?
Because it is a delta area. Whether or not it originally was just simply open ocean and then it was filled in by silt being brought down by the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. The two rivers come within 25 miles of each other, and there's been some debate as to whether they maybe have shared a common mouth at once upon a time. But this whole area, which is, I think about the size of the state of Oregon, I guess it is, it's just a tundra, flat tundra region, virtually treeless except some trees along the river in the upper regions. And it's a very soft land. There's no rocks anywhere near. When they put gravel roads in Bethel, they have to bring gravel from 125 miles upriver down by barge because there's none there. It's all just this very soft sand carried down by the rivers. And it's even walking across the tundra, you can't walk very far. I mean, it's very tiring. It's like walking on a mattress. And you encounter, streams and meltwater lakes. Nobody really walks very far during the summer. You might get out of a boat, walk a few yards here and there or a quarter of a mile when picking berries, for instance. But you generally travel by summer across the ground as you don't travel very far.
Robin, you quoted a fellow, Nick O'Nick, I think was his name. It's from the book, but it's also in an Alaska Magazine article that you put together based on the book. He said something about the land. I've seen the land in the lower 48. It's very sturdy.
Sturdy. Yeah.
My land is not like that.
Mm-hmm. What I think about the idea of the land and the sea sort of compromising with one another is lace. If you fly in an airplane towards the coast, and Bethel is 80 miles from the coast, but it's not very much above sea level, these meltwater lakes become more and more numerous. They don't have any inlets or outlets. They just sit there on the permafrost. And as you get towards the sea, the land looks like a lace that becomes lacework that's more and more open as you reach the edge of it. And also, what one doesn't realize until you've been out in boats and traveled along the edge of the land is that it's very shallow. That land continues out underneath the water. There are channels that people in the villages become familiar with. they almost tend to think of that water that's very shallow as land also, because it has a topology that they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And they have a sense of it as being land. So that near the edge of the sea, the land is very much like the sea. There's a lot of water in it. And once you cross that boundary into the sea, it's almost like land because there's sandbars and channels and it has a real configuration to it, not in the way that we think of the sea.
I talked with a fellow who lived out in one of the coastal villages, and he was describing about how by boat he would go down the Bering Sea coast and then enter the Kuskokwim River. And I said, well, as you do that with your skiff, were you outside of the sight of land? And he said, oh, yes. And I said, well, how do you navigate out there? And he says, well, I know that country. And I what he's referring to is knowing the subtleties of currents and sandbars and all those sorts of things that you or I going out would not necessarily find visual.
Right. I'm thinking about how a person knows a city. He knows all the street signs. He knows all the buildings, but there are no street signs. There are no buildings to our eyes, to my eyes.
The intimacy that people know about land out there when since there's so many generations going back thousands of years that people have lived there, you start finding that generation after generation, the subtleties of all things are passed down, and you become aware even yourself after living out there for a while and traveling around by snow machine of watching for bushes and little small things that give you clues as to where you are and what's going on, that at first you don't even notice at all, you don't even pay attention to, but they become very important guides.
This is Conversations. We're talking today with Jim and Robin Barker. Their collaborative work, Jim as photographer, Jim as writer, and Robin as editor, is called Always Getting Ready. And Always Getting Ready, where'd this title come from?
Well, that was that came about, we seem to have a difficult time finding titles for books. And so one time, I dropped by. This is after searching for about a year. I kind of act like
searching for a year for a title.
For a title, I was kind of acting like the hunter who said that he seems like he gets the most birds when he can act like he is not looking for them. And so I was kind of acting the same way with the title, thinking, well, if I don't search for it, it will it'll come my way. But
I have to say that we drove all of our friends nuts.
Oh, yes.
Trying to think of a title.
Worse than a new baby.
But one of our friends did come through for us, so
yes,
it was worth it from our point of view.
So I dropped by Agnes Kelly Bostrom's office downtown, and I said, is there any kind of wording or any phrase that near the end of winter, as people are beginning to kind of gear up for the major subsistence activity that kind of starts occurring right at the end of winter as spring starts coming. Is there anything that is said, hoping to find some word? And she just started saying, all through the year we are getting ready for fishing, for berry picking, for potlatches, getting ready for winter. We are always getting ready to go somewhere to get foods. And because we are so religious, we are always getting ready for the next life. And there I was, just scribbling down as fast as I could, that was the title.
Always Getting Ready. Mm-hmm. This has a companion thought in the Yupik language, which is also in the dedication page of the book. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that as well? I think those are two foundation points, this quote from Agnes Kelly Bostrom and then this other piece.
Yeah, as we say, I am told that being ever prepared is a common caution from Yupik elders to young people, whether they are preparing for fishing or a trip to the city. Implicit is the understanding that one must be wise in knowing what to be prepared for, and equally wise in being prepared for the unknowable.
This refers as much to the dangers you would meet outside the close community of people in the world, as it does to a sulfur preparation. Is that right?
Yeah. The nice thing that I really thought a lot about this that she went ahead and described too to me is that in this being prepared, and the caution to a person heading out for travel is when traveling, you don't really know exactly what you're going to encounter. And so not only one must take the right equipment along, but also be mentally prepared, be, in a sense, cleared, ready to take on any eventuality and not have, you know, preconceived thoughts and such that might limit one's ability to meet these.
One of the reasons I like the title is that it does reflect a very special stance that UPICs have towards the future, where we might plan. This is getting ready, but there's an essential difference between planning and just being prepared. Being prepared is a state of being. And I think that for UPICs, it's a little presumptuous to say ahead of time too much what's going to be. And so that preparation takes on a special ambiguousness, but that ambiguousness is really part of who you are as a UPIC person, not trying to nail things down too much ahead of time, but having to be prepared for virtually anything.
Well, you know, the other side of this is that when talking about subsistence is that I think there may be some impressions that that people who live a subsistence life just sit out there and kind of shoot food as it comes by. And the idea here is that I really liked was that no, you've really got to be actively involved, as one of the quotes in our book says, this old fellow from Nightmute, he says, if you stay in the village, you won't make 5 cents. You have to get up and move around. You have to really work at it. And always getting ready, you know, suggests the work involved in making subsistence work.
Mm-hmm. The other side of this is something I found in your introduction, which you seem to be talking about, Robin, when you say the UPICs believed, and this is the going back through the centuries, the UPICs believed they were just one form of life among other living things of equal respectability. Does this also have to do with what you mean when you talk about always being ready?
Well, yeah, I don't want to presume to speak for everyone, but I do think that if you see yourself as living in a reciprocal stance with the rest of the world, you don't say on the 26th of September I'm going to shoot a moose. You understand that you're going to place yourself out there, and what happens may happen. I think a good example of that is the seal hunting trip that you took to Alakanuk Jim, mm-hmm. when the ice conditions made it impossible for seals to be gotten. And so everybody was prepared to jig for tom cod, was it?
That's right. They had traveled 20 miles out across Bering Sea ice, and the weather conditions had blown up chunks of ice against their ice edge, virtually preventing them from hunting because there wasn't any open water. So they pulled out jigging lines and all day fished for tom cod. I estimated somewhere in bringing back maybe 75 pounds of fish, you know, per person, and in that way helping to pay for the trip. At least they brought back something.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a failure, it's just transformed.
That's right.
All right. With us today on Conversations, Jim and Robin Barker. I want to ask you about your stance as tour, your attitude as a photographer. Do you feel a kinship with this attitude of always being ready as a photographer?
To the extent that I don't carry a camera around all the time, if I'm at work on something, then yes. In other words, I try to kind of get into a state of preparation for shooting, and it sometimes takes a few minutes to really get into a heightened sense of awareness and being able to move around comfortably with the people that I'm photographing. It takes a while to kind of get within their pace, you know. And one of the things I learned was that, and working in the villages, is that if I could maybe photograph even a tenth of some of the things that I saw and would have liked to photograph, that I had to be kind of comfortable in accepting that, instead of, in other words, instead of just rushing about shooting, you know, very fast, moving at a comfortable pace, and getting those things when I could, and having to let a lot of things go.
So the process of photography for you is as much internal as it is external. Does that make sense, or is
yes,
it?
Yes. Yeah. I feel it is. There are certain conscious things, you know, that I'm looking for. I mean, if I'm seeing there's a couple people over there doing something, then of course I consciously move myself into that position, you know, and I consciously try to kind of position myself so that I can see their faces. But then I feel like I court luck. The way I speak about it is that I kind of court the subconscious urges to come forward, and for the shutter to be released almost by surprise, as if it's being released by something beyond conscious, at a conscious level. I feel like my photographs are most lyrical that way, when they are not completely consciously contrived. I mean, if I am in a situation where I am consciously contrived the whole thing, positioning myself, saying I'm going to do it when I shoot exactly when that person does that and that, it's a very flat, thought out picture. That if I can operate at a in some cases a fairly rapid level of perception, and the shutter release just kind of almost by an internal urge, then there's something about the picture that's far more lyrical, that I really court. I mean, I realize that that's the real, that becomes real substance then.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about this photograph right at the front of the book. There are four people. They're in a boat, spray mm-hmm. all around them, and it seems like it's very cold, and mm-hmm. they are clustered together. Where were you going? What were you doing?
Well, I was getting a ride back from Kwikluk, where I was photographing a health aide for a couple days, and they offered me a ride back. This was a picture that has always stood very high in my mind as being, a very kind of symbolic of much of my work, and yet it was taken within a month or so of actually being there. And so, even though I think in terms of living and working with people for a long period of time, so that they are comfortable with me, and I get to feel like I'm an inside observer instead of being an outside observer. Here's this picture that really works. It's, you know, very early on. Mm-hmm. And I was just riding back in the boat with him. And I saw this scene, and I shot virtually a whole roll of film. And at one moment, the woman put up her hand pointing to something, and it really made the picture. Now, the thing that to me is interesting about it is, and I talk about this when I show the pictures to classes, is that here are people going along in the cold, and they're very comfortable about kind of, moving up and leaning against each other and staying warm that way. Whereas I think probably many of us, if we were in a cold boat going along, we'd probably go to opposite ends of the boat, you know, and
hunker down,
you know.
Yeah, huddle separately.
Yeah,
you know, sure.
That's a very cultural difference there.
That's one of the things that caught me first about this photograph was this closeness, this intimacy that I don't know that, as you say, white folks would probably move to opposite ends of the boats and look at each other coldly.
Yeah. But you learn too that you don't fall down walking on the ice with four legs where you do with two. So if you lock arms and walk through the village, it's a lot more likely that you're going to stay upright as you go.
And it means something quite different.
It Well, it you have to be comfortable in order to do that. Mm-hmm. But if that's what everybody's doing, it becomes easier right. to do that, too.
I'm Susan McGinnis. I'm your host for Conversations. With me, Jim Barker, called one of the best ethnographic photographers in the state of Alaska. Jim was educated at Washington State University at Pullman, also at Los Angeles Art Center School of Design, where he studied photography, and at San Francisco State University. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Anthropology. With us also, Robin Barker, an East Coast girl, Jim Barker, a West Coast fellow, Robin from the East Coast. She was educated at Smith, Dartmouth, and Tufts. She took her Bachelor of Arts in Child Study from the prestigious Elliott Pearson School of Child Study at Tufts. She's currently pursuing a Master's in Language and Literacy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Robin has spent just about all of her professional career working with special needs adults, children, and families, much of that time spent in Bethel. She currently supervises student teachers for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. Jim is a freelance photographer. He spent a good deal of time working both in what we call arts photography, as well commercial photography and freelance photography. Jim and Robin Barker, our guests today on Conversations. I want to ask the two of you about essentially being a West Coast boy and an East Coast girl meeting in Bethel and working in Bethel intimately with people who are not of the West and East Coasts, but and of an entirely different culture than yours. There's a word, Cossack, that comes from Cossack.
That's right.
That means, depending on how you look at it, it can mean barbarian, it can mean outsider. It essentially means white person.
That's right.
Come new.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How have you learned to transcend your whiteness, your very difference from the people with whom you're working?
You don't transcend your whiteness.
Thank you.
To begin with. When we first, Jim arrived in Bethel about a year before I did. We met in Bethel. And I suppose that our differences, East Coast, West Coast, might have seemed more important in a different context. When I first arrived, about 20% of Bethel were Gussocks. And there were, I think, three blonde women, at least, in Bethel. And it was very amusing because my Yupik friends confused the three of us. We didn't look anything alike. But we were hard to tell apart because we were all blonde. Learning to get along and making friends and becoming part of a community has some of the same aspects it would anywhere, except that in a vastly different cross-cultural situation, you make more mistakes. And I'm really grateful that people are very tolerant. And I sometimes wish that people would explain things more to me. I could tell that I might have made an error, but not known what it was. Sometimes it took me a long time to figure out, for instance, that you don't turn down food mm-hmm. when it's offered. But people are so polite that I'm sure I hurt quite a few people's feelings before I realized that that I was doing that. So I guess the hardest thing for me, being from the East Coast, was learning to shut up, learning to be quiet and listen, and learning that an enormous pause was not necessarily making people uncomfortable, that I didn't have to make people comfortable by filling in all the gaps with talk. And once I learned that and told myself to just be still and watch and listen, then I really began to learn things and learn to appreciate things. The other thing that was very hard for me to learn was this idea of not planning ahead, not trying to know ahead of time everything that's going to happen. Most of the time that I was working in Bethel for that dozen or so years, I was working in the villages and just flying in and out and getting places when you expect to get to places, or holding a meeting when you think you're going to hold a meeting, and so on. For an East Coast person who works on a timeline, it was a wonderful learning experience for me to just give myself up to the weather, give myself up to what was happening in the village, and learn to live by the rhythms around me rather than trying to create rhythms for myself. So I think those are the two things that I got out of.
You know, Bethel is a very socially a very unique place. That when we were there, there was an active interest by UPICS and Bethel to kind of draw people in. It's an unusually warm community. If you give even the slightest sign that you're going to kind of like stay there and commit yourself to being there, I never really tried to learn much language from there. I did learn, you know, enough words and such so that sometimes I could kind of tell what people were talking about. But most people are pretty much bilingual now. Only early on did I run into situations where I had to kind of look for somebody in the village to be able to speak English to. But I'm not a hunter, so I didn't go out hunting. Photography sometimes seems a little bit like sniping. But there's always, an unusual warmth shown, particularly going to villages and going back a second time. You know, that was really an important thing. And so a lot of the villages I'd been back to many times. And people are always very gracious and welcoming me back.
The book is called Always Getting Ready. It's author and photographer Jim Barker, editor Robin Barker. Let's turn to the book.
When I first was there, I worked for a couple of years for the public broadcast station, just as a means of kind of getting my feet on the ground. And one of the persons I worked with who has become fairly well known is John Active. One day when phones were finally being installed, one phone per village. You know, before then, the only communication in and out of the village was by radio with the BIA, you know, school. And so phones were being put into the village. And so I suggested to John, why don't you call Tuxluk Bay and record a conversation with them about what it's like having a phone for the first time. So he called up, and he spoke in Yupik, but he translated to me. So we did a story on Tuxluk Bay on the day theirs was hooked up. John Active, the Yupik news director, called the village, and a man's voice answered. John congratulated him in Yupik, and the man responded that the village had now had the phone for 24 hours. He added that the weather was just fine that day, and all the other men were out seal hunting, but, he concluded in a wistful voice, I have to sit here and answer this phone.
Tuxluk Bay in major transition.
Yes.
I want to take you to another place in this book. It's a story told by Carl Coagley from mm-hmm. Bethel about hunting.
Well, Carl, I'd gotten to know Carl quite well working on the Kuskokwim 300 together. We did a lot of trail work, and he decided he really wanted to tell me about some of his, when he was young, what his family life was like. And this is from the village of Akiak, which is 40 miles upriver from Bethel, I'm going to break into the middle of a story where in the spring or latter winter, his family would go by dog team. I think it was probably like 60 to 80 miles across the tundra to the Kilbuck Mountains and then go up into the Kilbuck Range over toward the Nushagak side. So this picks up kind of as they're traveling up there. My Aunt Alice, she'd set her traps. Well, you or I could only go around once during the day, but she'd be out all day checking those traps. She'd eat a little salmon for nourishment. If her snowshoes break down, she'd fix them while she's checking her traps. She was resourceful. What do you call buckbrush? It's long willow. During the winter, the snow flattens them down. And during the spring, when the snow starts melting, this brush starts springing back up just as soon as the sun gets warm. My dad always told me, when that brush starts springing up, you'd better get the hell out of there and head back home. May 24th was the time my father would always start home, start from the Nushagak side. And I'll never forget it. There would still be lots of snow, and we'd travel mostly at night when the snow gets hard. That's when you make lots of mileage. When we'd be traveling, I'd look back to where we were just a couple days before, and it'd be just a blue haze. We'd go to the head of the Keezeralik River where our ancestors, they'd make the skin boats just below the lake. They'd assemble the framework, and then they'd soak the skins, and then they'd start sewing the skins together. And they'd go out and get lots of grass, burn the grass, and then the tallow from the caribou would be mixed with the burned grass, and it's just like tar. Then they'd lice the skins onto the frames, and then they'd put this burned grass tallow mixture on all the seams. It'd take 4 or 5 days to make the boat, at the most. The boat would be about 20 feet long, big enough to carry everything, dogs, whole family, pelts, sled. Other families would be up there at the same place making boats. Sometimes two families don't see each other for a month, and then they'd build boats and come down the river together. Here's a whole family traveling down the river in a boat that they've just kind of made from skins, you know, quickly. And how you'd have to do that and do it safely. Here's your whole family in a very exposed situation.
Made out of just the things that come to hand.
That's
just
right.
The thing, yes, this is the thing that struck me so much about that passage, is that from a Western point of view, these people started with nothing in the middle of nowhere, and yet they created their transportation, their means to go hunting, mm-hmm. their means of storage, and to get safely home again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fairly extraordinary passage. This book is about the seasons of the year. Tell me about the seasons as the book exposed them, as the book created them for you.
Well, this is the sort of problem that editors stumble on, and that is thinking about the structure of the book. When we sat down with a great stack of spiral notebooks, which were Jim's field notes, and began to talk about how this all might fit together, his idea was to follow a year through the seasons and to use anecdotes and descriptions that would complement the photographs. The book does jump around from one place to another, and there are different activities going on at the same time in different parts of the delta, depending on whether you're in the interior or on the coast, and depending on whether you happen to be where the herring come in sometime in May, or happen to be where the herring come in sometime in June. So that there was some difficulty just in creating a sequence that followed the year from the spring around through the winter. But we also found that we kept running up against this idea of, well, when are we done with spring? And when are we starting summer? And we kept moving bits from one part of the book to another. Oh, this is summer stuff. This goes here. Oh, this is spring. This is fall. And what we gradually began to realize is that the year doesn't fall into four seasons in the way that you think of them if you read Dick and Jane and grew up in the temperate zone.
Mm-hmm.
That the rhythm of the year depends somewhat on where you are, and that berry picking is a season. You know, people refer to berry picking as a season. It's sort of halfway between summer and fall. That spring is, I think of ice when I think of spring. So we had to sort of let go of the four season idea. You'll notice that the chapters are divided into what are actually month names, and they span several months each chapter. And there's some overlap depending on what's included in that chapter, so that the book is a sort of fluid progression through the year that jumps from place to place. But it has the feel, I think, of moving from one activity to another, which is what the seasons are about.
In fact,
that's how they're named, too. I mean, of course, these month segments in which are not really months at all, but they're like we were just reading from a portion that was called a time when the birds have young and break up, and then that's followed by a period that was called fish hitting, which might be because, you know, when you pull salmon into the boat, you got to clobber them, you know. And so all of the season, well, segments of the year are broken up by these rather descriptive terms.
Mm-hmm. I like the worst of the moon, which is deep in the winter, and we're not really sure whether that's December or January, because and we actually tried to pin down month names that related to the to the 12 calendar months that we have. And it can't be done. Ethnographers in the past tried to say, well, worst of the moon is December, because this old man told me in December that it was worst of the moon. Well, in fact, the Yupik calendar is a lunar calendar, which has 13 months in it, and doesn't end in the same place that it began. So that depending on which ethnographer came at what end of the month, they might have had a different name for, or the same name for two different months.
This time, worst of the moon, is the, whichever month it is for us, it's the deep dead of winter when, when the focus is more on family, relationship, dancing, and the like. Is there a section from this portion, a short piece you'd like to use to introduce it for us?
The in the seasons, and the Yupiks moved around considerably from camp to camp, always, you know, following kind of places were food sources and fall, eventually they'd end up at fall camp where for and then from there they would during the deepest part of winter, 3 or 4 months, they would go back to their home village site. And it meant that people that had been gone from each other for quite a few months, 8 or 9 months of the year, were all back together again at the village. And so it became really a time of a lot of feasting and dancing, and so all much of the dancing went on during the winter.
The last section of the book is all about dancing. And it does seem to make a shift, because all of the previous seasonal sections talk about different subsistence activities. But the way that it ties together is that the essence of the lyric and the motions in the dance is about subsistence and the relationship, a celebration of people's relationship with each other and very much with the rest of the world. A lot of the songs are about hunting and fishing and about animals. And so really the winter is in many ways a celebration of the subsistence continuum. So we felt that it really was a nice culmination for that seasonal round, so that it became the final section of the book.
And this is part of this always getting ready cycle, right?
And in many ways, a lot of the songs are about subsistence and all kinds of activities, and it seemed a fitting way to close. There was a particular section here where I was had interviewed two women, Helen Smith and Neva Rivers from Hooper Bay, and they were describing what it was like going into the men's house where all of the dances were held back when they were really young. And she started out, both of them, and in somewhat halting English, "We danced our own way from our ancestors," began Helen. "It's really a big sod house. Everybody would sit down from the oldest down to the youngest men. They would put us children on those shelves on the walls. In wintertime, they close the main door, and then they go underneath down there and come up in the middle of the room, the fire pit. When us kids come in, we would hold up our arms and ask them to pull us up. All of us children would be really quiet. The Kosgiak would be just like a holy place. At Hooper Bay, the Kushunik, now Chivak, would come over. Kayalovik, now Nutak, and Scammon Bay, coastal people, they used to walk or go by sled. Not many dogs, maybe one dog. Long time ago, they never used to have real dog teams. They used to use one dog and walk at the side of the sled. Most of the people walk. They used to have a big feast sometimes. Lots of agudak, frozen fish, lots of oiled bread. They'd make all those big pots of tea and everybody eat right there. 5 young men would go on top of the Kosgiak. They'd make noise. They make lots of noise, yelling, just like howling dog. That means that tonight they're going to have a really, really biggest dance, bring lots of gifts." That's kind of sets the stage for how big event these dances were.
Jim, and still are. There are descriptions in the chapter also of contemporary dances where everyone comes together from different villages and celebrates the winter and the time one has to visit and so on.
Jim Barker and Robin Barker. Jim reading from Always Getting Ready. This book was published in April of 1993 by the University of Washington Press.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. It contains 93 photographs and a 42,000-word text. That's a pretty extraordinary number. And is based on photography and field notes from over 18 years of observation by Jim Barker.
Yes, we had to have some text in there so it would be radio compatible.
It's very important. I've been mourning not being able to show our listening audience the photographs from these books, from this book, mm-hmm. Which are quite extraordinary. What was it like for the two of you working on this book together? Your photographs, your words from over 18 years of experience, and Robin as an editor. What?
Well, I think that it all happened pretty much one summer when we were here in Fairbanks. The major part of the writing, and I'd be going through my field notes and pulling things out and getting them, getting them down and getting them somewhat organized, and then it kind of transferred over to Robin, who would kind of wend this stuff together. And there were times when I think that we were almost in tears, kind of going through our and trying to edit and put things together, kind of reliving a lot of this, a lot of these events that, in some cases, we travel together. And often, though, we were out in villages traveling separately, doing separate, different things completely. It was a particularly moving summer, and luckily kind of warm because we worked outside on the out on a picnic table a lot, putting it together.
A hard process, easy process?
It was really fun. It was a lot of work. And it was very interesting. It's funny that Jim's memory of it is that it all happened in one summer, because what did happen is that he took this enormous stack of field notes and just poured them into the computer, and my memory of it is that it took rather a bit longer than one summer, because I was sort of working at the other end, reorganizing. And reworking things, adding sections as the press and as various readers suggested things needed to be fleshed out. We read aloud a lot to each other, which was really enjoyable. But for me, it was very interesting because we felt right from the beginning, first of all, that this is a photographic book and that the focus needed to be on the photographs. That the text is a complement to that, and that it needed to be presented in a very personal way, that the sense of being there through the photographs needed also to be reflected in the text, which is why it's written in the first person. So that put me in the odd position of writing and rewriting in Jim's voice, writing first person. And so I needed to be mindful always that I was working from his notes, and that the vocabulary, the lexicon needed to be Jim's. And so this is very much, his point of view. But that was sort of fun. I remember one point when I totally reworked a section of the book of the story about Uncommute.
Yes, yeah.
And thinking very carefully about moving sentences around and inserting words, but always trying to keep his voice alive. Mm-hmm. And after a week or so, he went in and he read that section after I had reworked it totally and said, sometimes I do sit down and things come out just right. I thought, well, I did okay that time.
Let's just leave this in the original.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Nicely done.
But, that some parts of it needed more work, and some parts of it just, of course, a lot of it is people's words. And Jim has done a tremendous amount of interviewing and verbatim notes. He's wonderful about that. I never was very good about doing that when I'm too busy drinking tea and gossiping when I'm in the village. But so we wanted also to keep people's voices from the communities as part of the text. I think that more than anything else is what keeps it alive.
I really place a lot of importance on the way people say things, and it wasn't always possible for me to carry a tape recorder, but I would, as I would be traveling with people and things, conversations would go on, I would kind of note down, you know, like key words, or even write out particularly key phrases the way people say things, you know, that I thought was really, you know, that really reveals something about them. And then at night would write extensively everything that went on during the day, and names of people, I mean, all kinds of things that I would put, and much of the conversation that and observations that I had. This was all done, all these field notes were done not with in mind to use them in the future, but more really trying to sharpen my observational skills down the line, and just kind of keep things in order.
In fact, the first time we went to the press,
University of Washington Press,
we walked in with a huge stack of photographs. We had an hour appointment, and Naomi Pascal, who's the managing editor there, sat down and looked through the photographs, and we started telling stories. But what we said to her was that we were looking for an author to write a short text to go with the photographs. But after 2 hours of storytelling and looking at the photographs, she turned to us and said, "Give it a try. Mm-hmm. Have you got any notes?" And we rolled our eyes because Jim had these. Well, I guess we had mentioned that we might be able to turn the notes over to an author if we could find one. She said, "Give it a try. Send me a draft."
Nice. I mentioned earlier that Robin Barker supervises student teachers within the Fairbanks North Star Borough. She does this for the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Education, where she is employed on the faculty as a clinical supervisor. For the past 16 years or so, she has worked mostly with special needs families, adults and children, through the Fairbanks Resource Agency, through Yukon Kuskokwim Parent Child Program, through Bethel Social Services, and in those organizations providing direct services, worked as a teacher, worked as a trainer and a supervisor for field workers. The people she works with are children and adults with emotional, intellectual, developmental, or physical disabilities, and with their families. Robin Barker, the editor of the book Always Getting Ready, brought out this year by the University of Washington Press. Jim, I want to ask you what makes a successful photograph. I think this must be a question that's answered from the soul of the beholder. From each individual photographer will see that answer differently. And I'm interested, because your photographs are so intimate, to know what is a successful picture, and when do you know?
My intent when photographing people is to reveal the personalities of the context, the environmental and social context of the people as much as possible. When that's really, you know, when there's something about that person that really comes across, then to me that becomes successful. Ideally, then, if all of this can be couched within a framework of where it's pleasant to look at, you know? But most importantly, it has to do with when photographing people, is how the clarity of the personality that it comes across, and the combination both of photographs with the words. I mean, it's all kind of trying to make the people as visible as possible.
When did you pick up a camera?
I think it really began pretty much in early college. I had taken some photographs in high school, but not really very seriously. Entered college initially with a music scholarship, but I was really kind of drawn to photography and ended up going down to Los Angeles Arts Center School, which is now in Pasadena, but generally I would say that in my work as an ethnographic photographer, I'm pretty much self-trained.
Is it a I asked you a minute ago about a successful photograph. Do you consider that work hard? Is it difficult, challenging to make that?
Well, if things are going well and for the there's lots of activity out in front and the inspiration of it, carries me along and it's not hard at all.
So it's back to those earlier thoughts about kind of intuitive photography. That's the core for you.
Yeah, and a lot of creative people have kind of said things in a similar way. One of the French composers mentioned about how one has to know a great deal about music and then write about what one doesn't know about. And the whole idea of kind of reaching out a little bit beyond what you can really grasp, as if we have a certain kind of subconscious control of something beyond what we can consciously organize. That's the kind of stuff that I feel like good photographers, good painters, poets always kind of reach for.
Mm-hmm. The photographs from Always Getting Ready, I should say, have been on exhibit, have been presented in exhibits in three different places, in 1992, and 1993. In 1992, from May until September, the Anchorage Museum of History and Art had the exhibit Always Getting Ready. From March through May of 1993, the Burke Museum at the University of Washington in Seattle. From July through September of 1993, the University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum. Once again, the book is Always Getting Ready. What attracted you to ethnographic photography? You did a long series on a family in California, which is also an ethnographic study.
Well, the family study in California started that I had seen photographic books of family life, families all throughout the world, and I thought, it really interests me to take one family and really work with it a lot. And I happened to find this. It wasn't that I was kind of going out to do a family study. I actually ran into these very unique people, and I was quite and I was kind of drawn into them, and it's kind of like, well, why don't we try this with this family? So I spent 2 years working with them. There's something about liking the idea of working at, taking a lot of time working at something and taking looking at the photographs, reshooting, doing all, compiling a lot of material until I feel like I've really kind of replicated something that is really there, and then kind of trying to put it all together.
So it's kind of recreating within the medium of the photograph.
That's right. Huh. Yeah.
Same sort of thing with Always Getting Ready, yes?
Yeah. Yeah. I just like that idea of making things all kind of fit together. And when I'm starting out on doing something, I have no idea where it's going to go, where it's going to lead. And it just kind of goes and goes. And for I wasn't really, when I was photographing and living in Bethel, wasn't really with the intent of doing a book. But I was just enjoying the process of learning. It was really a tremendously vital kind of learning experience for me, and it was just kind of documented what I was learning.
This isn't the first publication for either of you, although this is in many ways a peak peace, always getting ready. But Robin, you have worked on publications in the past. Jim, you have one of the ones, kind of a celebratory book by the city of Bethel called Bethel, the First 100 Years. So there's certainly this kind of work in your background. Have you two another project in mind that will combine experience and photographs? Or are you always getting ready? Is the future more open than that?
We laugh sometimes. Sometimes I think the next book will be mostly text, written in my voice, with a few photographs. But I don't know what that would be. I don't think so, but we enjoy so much working together that who knows what might be around the corner.
We have no particular things in just some ideas, future directions, but nothing specific at this point.
Things have a funny way of creeping out into life and looping back on themselves. I was thinking about those photographs of the family. When I first met Jim, when we were courting, if people still do that, one of my first memories was seeing those photographs of those children in that family and thinking, this is a pretty nice guy. And then, in the last several weeks, we've had phone calls from those children who have now grown up and are interested in seeing the book, seeing Always Getting Ready. Mm-hmm. So there's a loop in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Jim Barker, Robin Barker, I want to thank you very much. I have a feeling that those few sketchy ideas will bear fruit and we'll see more. In the meantime, there is Always Getting Ready from the University of Washington Press and exhibits to look forward to. Robin Barker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan.
Jim, thanks very much.
It's been
a most pleasurable hour. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. I hope you'll join me again next week.